This week on the Ocean Cruises podcast, we are speaking with Lauren and Eric from the YouTube sailing channel Sailaware World Sailing. Lauren and Eric are currently cruising the Caribbean with their son Rivers and their dog Zeke. They are longtime sailors and have owned many boats. They are currently sailing a Hunter 46 LE. Whilst enjoying some club racing back in the day, they both met at Lake Erie and have been gradually moving south since, spending time sailing, then cruising, and now as full-time liveaboards. If you want to learn more about Lauren and Eric, you can visit their YouTube channel, Sailaware World Sailing. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, watch the interviews on YouTube, and download the audio on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. If you'd like to become a supporter of the podcast, consider becoming a Patreon at patreon.com/oceancruisers.
No, we're back in the USVI now.
Right, yeah. Okay.
We took,
Just about a month, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly a month.
Yeah, because then we got kicked out. We just didn't extend our visa in time.
So. There's a lot of red tape to keep your boat for more than a month. Yeah. It takes a lot of running around to different places and some extra cash. And we had a couple other little boat dramas, and we're like, hey, maybe we're supposed to leave now.
Yeah. Yeah, all the signs are there. Let's get out.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So you guys, you have to get a visa to go to the British Virgin Islands.
Yeah. I don't know how it differs for us from other nationalities, but for us, it was really simple getting over there. You log into the EC Clear or Sail Clear, whichever, I get them mixed up, and just register your trip. They want you to be vaccinated. All three of us are vaccinated, so that was no big deal. Mm-hmm. And then we just tested there because it was $50 each to test on site.
Well, right, it's not bad. Live.
And yeah, it's like 150 here. So,
whoa.
Yeah.
In the US Virgin Islands.
Yeah.
$150 each. Well, hang on. Yeah, so you had to pay like $450 to get your family in there.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
That's nuts. So, whoa, yeah, that's bad.
Yeah.
You know, I hope it's nice.
It is nice. If you're a US citizen, you can usually, we've usually checked in with the CBP Rome app and haven't really had to deal with much of that. But I know it can be expensive for most. But yeah.
The world we live in. I
know. Less and
yeah,
less
that's
though.
Crazy.
Yeah.
And is that the same if people like turn up on an airplane and you want to go there for a vacation, or is it different because you're on a boat?
I think it's the same, but most people we know test before they. We've had a few friends fly into the USVI and they test before they leave. Hmm. And yeah, and a lot of people now are doing the home tests where you log on with a nurse and do all that.
All right.
And it's much cheaper if you can get a hold of them. We couldn't get a hold of any. So,
yeah, because that's the problem now. Eh? I was listening on the news. Like, a lot of the guys in America were saying that it's actually just difficult to even get to a pharmacy and find the home tests.
Yeah. 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 Our friend who came to visit us, they managed to do it. They got some free ones, I think, from a library or something like that. And but here they ran out just like, bam.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah. Any of those islands. Yeah, I'd be okay with that. 150,
yeah.
No way. We sailed over to Martinique, over the new year. And Martinique was like super easy. They didn't ask for anything. And it was like to check in, they send you to a bar. And then when you check in and you pay like €5, they give you a beer as well. I was like, this is fantastic.
That's St. Martin too. And that's how we checked into St. Martin last year. And there's different info that you read or hear about what's required. But at the French Islands, it seems to be that's the case. Guadeloupe, we've heard that from a French citizen.
Easy.
Same thing. But yeah, it's Isle Marine, which is a chandlery. And it's right there on Marigot Bay. You literally can dinghy right up to it. And it was free. And the guy just comes over and you're doing your own thing on the computer. He comes over, stamps your passport, and you don't get a beer. But
well, you can spare that. Yeah, you can spare that. It's just so weird that like some of the islands are so flexible and other, like, I mean, $150 yeah. for a test to get in, like they're losing business without doubt.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And when we left Grenada, obviously it was more in the height of COVID and all this, but the amount they charged to check out and to get tested was so much that it felt like they were trying to keep people there. Right. And we finally did because we'd been there for 6 months or something, and we wanted to go someplace else before Christmas a couple years ago. And so we wound up going to the St. Vincent and the Grenadines, but that was the most expensive out and in that we've had. Yeah. It was very expensive to check into SVG as well and put them together, and it was, you know, we're close to $1,000 just to go from one country to the next. Well, and we were traveling with friends that had two or three kids. So you can imagine how much it costs for them. But I don't know what it is now.
That's it's just bizarre. You know, because it's like I'm based in like the south of Spain in Europe. And right. the concept of paying to get into a country is just absurd for people over here. Like they wouldn't understand that like, at all. So like the idea for people from the Meds, like going over to the Caribbean, having to pay like $1,000 to get in somewhere. Yeah. It'd be like, what on earth is, I'm not going, you know?
No. And yeah, so many people were used to the old style of being able to just like hop from country to country, island to island, that we ran into some people who were really having a problem with the concept of all the loops and red tape and cost, but gotta pay it, gotta do it if you want to do it.
Yeah, there is a few downsides to living on a boat. And there's not many, like, to be fair, there isn't that many at all. So yeah, that's one of them. Cool. All right. So I tell you what, we'll just like start at the beginning. So like basically the people that like listen to the podcast, it depends on probably the guest, I'd say, it depends on, but each one like generally now gets between somewhere between 10,000 and 30,000. And I do not know the science to it. But like generally most people, they want to like know the backstory and like what guys' jobs you did and, you know, how you actually got your first boat, that type of stuff. So we'll get into it if that's cool. Hello, man. He's reading the news and he's on the news.
Do we need to relocate him again or you think he's okay?
You're going to be quiet?
It's like, I'm fine, guys. Come on.
We'll keep him on there. He can interject. If he hears some important news, he can throw his piece in.
Right.
Cool. So, all right. Before you guys, well, my phone just started talking to me. It's never done that before. Weird. You know, it started doing, do you know, like when you're having a conversation with your wife about like, oh, let's get like a new sofa. And then your phone pops up with the pictures of new sofas. You're like, oh my gosh, they're listening to everything.
It's creepy,
man. Yeah, I'll turn that.
Everything.
Yeah.
Get it away from me. Cool. So just starting off like right at the beginning, like what jobs did you do before you decided to start even saving up, I suppose, to get your first boat to travel on?
I mean, for us, it was a very gradual progression. Mm-hmm. We both have been sailing for 20 to 25 years.
Oh, wow.
We're from Ohio, and we met sailing on a small lake in Ohio, racing boats, 25-foot, roughly, cruiser boats, so like kind of casual Wednesday night racing. It's called the Allen Creek Sailing Association. It's an awesome organization. Her parents kind of helped to get the whole thing started. And so eventually, after years of both of us being there and sailing, we met, you know, during one of the Wednesday night races. And we had both separately done tons of sailing there and also up at Lake Erie, racing with friends on their boats up there. Pretty quickly we decided we wanted to move someplace where we could sail year round. And we chose Charleston.
Yeah. So we moved to Charleston in 2014?
I think so. Yeah.
And we took our boat down there to race. And then it just kind of kept evolving. I was a hairstylist, and Eric obviously still does the audiobooks. And when we were looking at moving either to a house or a boat in Charleston, we did look at a boat, but at the time it didn't seem like it would be doable with his job. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, things change, you know. That was a big deal. We wound up building a house in Charleston and eventually bought a bigger boat, which was the one we kind of started our channel with, which is a 35-foot Hunter Legend, which is a great sailing little boat, man. And we raced it a decent amount. But by then we had him, and so we weren't as hardcore about the racing stuff. Yeah.
Can you get me a drink?
If you're not doing anything,
he's the boss, you know.
Yeah. So we lived in Charleston for a while, and the equipment has changed so much since then. My equipment needs have gone down in size so far since those days. You know, now I can record audiobooks with what you're looking at right here and a laptop, and that's it. You know, I've got my interface here, and the rest is all software based. And it wasn't how it was when we moved to Charleston just that short amount of time ago. Mm. So, yeah, by the time we kind of decided we were going to take the plunge and try to do this, it was still a little bit of a risk for me. But I thought I could make it work in a small cabin on a boat. And so far we have. But, yeah, that was the progression. We lived in Charleston for 5 years. We'd built a house there, planned to move to Puerto Rico and take that boat with us and just rent a house and kind of sail out of Puerto Rico. But that was about 2 weeks before the hurricanes destroyed Puerto Rico.
Oh, right. Yeah. Okay.
Well, he was like 1.5. So it was like, we're not going to try and do that. So
dive into that.
Yeah.
That age.
We moved to Florida and then rented a house and then just decided let's go all in and look for a boat.
So you've progressively made your way further south.
It was. Yeah that's kind of how it was. I still miss that boat because of how well it sailed. And it's just a size difference mostly, but it just wouldn't have been for us. We really needed this size of boat with three cabins so that I could have that whole separate cabin for my studio. And that kind of put us in the zone that we were looking at for this boat. Mm-hmm. And so within a year we sold that first, sold Layla and bought this boat. And that was kind of it. Yeah. We took about 6 months to get the boat ready. We added a bunch of solar and got the water maker working again. It was kind of in bad state when we bought the boat. And then lots of little additions, nothing real major. The boat was in pretty good shape, but still, you know, takes about 6 months to do anything, it seems like. And that got us going. That was our start for cruising full time.
Yeah.
So you actually met like whilst you were sailing?
Yeah. Yeah.
I've never heard this crazy before. Right? Yeah. Speaks to a lot of sailing guys, people as well.
There's a lot of guys listening out there going, what?
How did you do that? Yeah.
Yeah. I'm one of the very, very lucky few that had a wife who was, she was so into sailing that when we met, I had a little Catalina 25 cruising boat. And there was also a spinnaker class. So a lot of those boats were S279s and J24s and stuff like that.
Okay.
And when we started seeing each other, I said, well, you got to come over and sail with me now, right? She's like, not until you get a spinnaker boat.
And I did.
Yeah. You had to.
Yeah. I'm like, well, I kind of wanted one of those anyway. So
did you know each other before actually going out sailing, or did you meet like at the sailing club?
We met at the sailing club.
Brilliant.
We had a little bit of an age difference. And so we had kind of met each other in previous lives, but,
He knew my parents better than me just because of the sailing club, because they had always been involved.
But you know that there needs to be an age difference between a man and a woman in a marriage, because the males are so immature, they need 15 years on the lady.
Right.
That's what I've heard.
That's true. That's a good way to look at it. I've never heard that angle, but that's very true.
It's very true. That's probably true. I'd say so. Like, yeah, without a doubt. Yeah.
Because they usually say the flip, you know, because of life expectancy or whatever. Mm. But frankly, I don't think the women want the men to hang around that long, you know.
That's sort of a factor, yeah.
I want to keep my mouth shut on that.
Right, so just excuse my ignorance on American geography, because I don't know it too well. So when you were in Ohio and you were sailing on the lakes, is that the Great Lakes?
Yes, yeah, Lake Erie borders the north side of Ohio. And it's a really cool cruising ground, and it's a great place to sort of get a feel for ocean sailing, because a lot of nasty stuff pops up there. And because of the shallow nature of the lakes and the fact that stuff blows in so fast, there's extreme weather up there sometimes. And yeah, so I got quite a lot of doses of that during racing overnight. And, you know, in those situations, you almost disregard the weather because it's a race, we're going, you know, no matter what. So yeah, I got to experience some really nasty sailing conditions, and you too, Lauren did as well. But I think that kind of helped cauterize us for the cruising life, because we know what really uncomfortable sailing can be like when you're racing on a boat. It's just, there's nothing you can do about it. You can't be the one to like flake out and go to bed. Right. You've got to stick it out.
Yeah. We've gotten kind of soft.
We have gotten
very
soft.
It's raining. I'm going to go down below. You can handle
it. Yeah. She brings me my foul weather gear and retires to the care of rivers.
Yeah.
It's good to come from that background though, when you're into cruising, because it's like there's a lot of weather where if you get caught out, you'd feel completely confident in your boat. Whereas people who probably haven't done like regattas, sailed in rough conditions, they get a little bit scared. So I find it helps. Like when I'm out with friends and who cruise mostly, they're getting like, oh God, the waves are too big. I'm like, this is fine, man. Like, what's the problem? Just beat into it and go for it.
Yeah.
Or not, or you can, you know, make a decision probably not the most sensible thing to do because you've got more experience.
Right. Yeah, and there's a much higher percentage of cruisers that we've met who are very new to sailing. And in their defense, I mean, the friends that we've made who have done it, they've done their homework and they know what to expect. But like you said, until you... When they get out there and something kind of bad the first time, they do come back with that story of like, oh my God, I was, you know. But, you know, it's just a different curve for everybody. And I'm happy that we came into it the way we did, because I feel like there's always obstacles and things to take care of and things to fix and weather to get through and all this kind of stuff. And if you can, we're lucky enough to take away some angles of that we don't have to be surprised about.
Right.
We wind up feeling like rookies, you know, 75% of the time. So,
yeah. I mean, there's always somebody who knows more anyway. Do you know what I mean? Like, you've always got stuff that you can learn and gain a bit more experience from.
Yeah.
So from Ohio, you then moved down to Charleston's in South Carolina.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. My geography is actually on point today. I'm doing okay.
Town. Yeah. You're on it.
Yeah, I know. It's not my country, but I don't know. Okay. So from there, you moved.
Yeah,
was that just a case of you wanted to move south to get like a bit of decent weather, or were you thinking about going further south so you could then get on a boat?
Not at that point. When we first moved, it was mainly just to get out of the winters, and it was about a 10-hour drive from where we were in Ohio, so it was still an easy drive to get back and forth and not too crazy.
Yeah.
So,
and again, a big sailing town.
Yeah.
When we were looking for some place to move to, which we literally were like, where could we go? That one stood out because they've got the Charleston Yacht Club and then CORA, which is the Charleston Ocean Racing Association. And they put on Charleston Race Week, which is one of the biggest regattas in at least in the U.S. for sure, every year. They have Wednesday Night Racing, they have kids programs, they have all that stuff. And that was just attractive to us because being sailors, and we didn't want to give up that part of it, that weekly sort of being part of something. And moving to Charleston allowed us to just sort of step right into a friend group and step right into an amazing new sailing association on really, really fun, difficult, challenging waters. The currents there are crazy, which we're talking to you. You'd probably be like, whatever. These aren't currents.
I was having a conversation with a friend, probably a couple weeks back, and they've just basically spent all the time cruising around the Caribbean, and they were talking about like really high tides. Like, what's it like in England? I was like, well, there's like 14 meter tides in a couple of places, like quite high. quite high. I think Canada's got the highest tide in the world, and then the UK's got like the second highest. Yeah, I think one spot in Canada in the very north has got like a 60 meter tide, I think. Either way, it's too much. Like where we had our first boat, that was like an 8 meter tide. So there was many times like we took it out and we just got stuck. We were like, oh, okay, like we can't go back, so let's just get more drunk. And then we just used to stay out. It's like nowhere to go. Right. Just all sand.
Yeah. Plus, they make so many of those boats with the twin keels. So if you're high and dry, you're just sitting there on your keels, get out, do a little bottom scrubbing. And
yeah, they're really popular in the UK.
Yeah.
Like if you go, like my parents have got a place in Wales, and it's like an island just off Wales. It's called Anglesey, mm-hmm. and you have to drive over, you know, these little queue bridges to get over to it. And you just see boats in the sand all over. So many builds. Mine is, although I can't actually use it now because I'm in the med. So our tide is like 60 centimeters. So pretty pointless up in it now. But yeah, if I wanted to say back to the UK, it's very easy to do your antifoul. You just park it on a beach and then do your antifoul and then sail off.
Yeah,
quite cool. So you said you built a property in South Carolina.
Yeah, we did. We built a house on James Island, and we were there for about 4 years, I would say. But when we started to get the notion that we wanted to be able to sail, you know, more places, more destinations, as great as Charleston is, it's quite a commitment even to sail down and go to the Bahamas from Charleston, time wise and effort. It's a difficult sail to get down there. And so we started thinking of possibly moving, and the housing market was definitely in our favor at that time. So that kind of played a part in our strategy of being able to get out of one boat and into the next and pay off a little bit of debt. And you know, we're not the cruisers who were able to scrap everything and pay everything off and buy their boat outright and just go. You know, we very much have a similar set of bills that we did when we were on land, minus the power bills and things like that. It's definitely better, but we were not the people who, you know, planned for years and saved for years. It's not in our nature.
Not that ever.
Yeah.
So sailing while still working was always part of the plan and still remains that way. And luckily, you know, I've been able to continue my work, and YouTube is starting to help out a decent amount as well. Still paying bills, still paying for the boat and all that. But just being able to get away sometimes is a challenge for almost anybody these days, to be able to go live a life someplace else, you know, especially mobile.
It's becoming a lot easier. I mean, like, especially after COVID, like, gosh, if there is any upside to COVID, I think it's people realizing that they don't have to go to an office 5 days a week, because it's completely unnecessary in a lot of cases. I mean, you know, obviously for a lot of jobs it is, but I think it's definitely shone a light on quite a lot of companies that, you know, you do not need to force people to come and sit in a room and share oxygen space like with everybody else, because, you know, good now.
Internet is still a challenge, but it's getting better for sure.
Yeah. And
I think most people who say they work while cruising are working in a situation that involves internet, consulting, conference calling, things like that. So, the requirements are pretty small. You just need a laptop and a good connection and some place to sit, and you're good. So Yeah. The internet, I think, is the biggest challenge for some people. We've met some people who were working while cruising, but they really needed to be certain that they were tethered to internet at all times. Luckily, we don't have to worry about that because, you know, I finish my projects offline and then just upload them. And sometimes that's a little bit of an adventure finding a place to do that. But it's gotten better even since we've been doing it. It's gotten better in the last, you know, 3 years. So
yeah,
that's why boats are selling like crazy right now.
I know prices are going up on some of them, like catamarans specifically. Like I've noticed there's certain models and years of catamaran that have not dropped in like 3, 4, 5 years. Or like the 2015 model is the same price as the 2010 model. Like, for example, there's just not that much difference in them anymore, which is, which is crazy. I mean, who thought you could make money by buying a boat, not doing anything and selling it?
And I keep seeing this going on, and I wonder what's going to happen in a couple of years, because there's going to be a lot of people who are feeling empowered by, you know, having worked at home for a while or realizing that's an option in some way and kind of wanting to get away from the craziness of the world, which, you know, that was part of our motivation too. And so they're running out and jumping into this lifestyle and buying these boats. But I got a feeling in like about a year or two, it's going to turn back into a buyer's market.
Yeah,
because it's not for everybody. And I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of boats that are back up for sale in a year or two. You know, when people maybe realize it's not for them, or, you know, get lured back into the workplace. And so they've got a boat that's sitting around not being sailed. And
yeah, I think so.
A roller coaster. Yeah,
I think like once all the markets pick up, like the different industries, not the markets, like the stock market, but I think once industry properly picks up, because things are still tough. Like, you know, it's like borders are opening, but like I work in oil and gas, and that is not happening all. There's just not much going on there. A lot of construction stuff still isn't working properly. So yeah, I think once that picks up, there'll probably be a bit more of a shift to like a normal life again. I hope so, because I need to get another boat in a couple of years, and I want to get a good price. You know, I don't want to be competing. Yeah. So at what point did you? So the boat that you had before, that was like a 35-foot Hunter or like a 36-foot, you said.
Yeah, 35. Yeah. It was like 35.7, so right in the middle. Yeah.
Okay, and you got that when you got to Charleston.
Right. Yeah, we sailed we had an S279, which was a little kind of racy boat before that. And when Rivers was on the way, we decided it was time to sell that boat and get something a little cruisier.
Yeah. I was told I wasn't allowed to be on spinnaker duty pregnant. So, right.
Baby boat in one arm, spinnaker in the other arm. Yeah.
Yeah. We got the family boat.
So we bought that boat in New Jersey and sailed it down to Charleston. And that was where we started filming, mostly to, you know, we thought it'd be fun to start a YouTube channel. Like a lot of YouTubers, we were already watching the ones who've been around for a long time, and thought it'd be a cool way for our families and friends from Ohio to like kind of see what we're doing. I don't think we ever really had a big plan of it being anything huge or anything like that. But so it took us, I think, what, a year before we started putting videos together from that first trip, or pretty close to
right,
it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, through that whole period with that boat, we weren't living on the boat. So for us, I kind of feel like for our YouTube history, that was a bit of our practice period, learning how to make videos. And then once we moved onto this boat, that was a pretty nice transition, because we already sort of had our whole method down of, you know, Lauren does most of the editing, and I do some audio tweaking, and I do the voiceover and stuff like that. And we had our system already sort of figured out. So it made it easy to continue doing it while also living on the boat full time this time around. Mm. So
what brought on that change in perspective? Cause like you were living in Charleston, and then you had so you're living in a house, you had a boat, which mm-hmm. you were like doing weekend cruising on and some extended cruising, that type of stuff. What gave you the motivation to then make that transition, be like, no home, just boat?
it's
a big jump, because it's like hobby into lifestyle. It's really different.
Right. Well, we went we tried to do a trip to the Bahamas on our boat on the 35 foot with my parents, and we didn't make it any further than Jacksonville, Florida.
Okay.
We were just having a lot of problems. And I remember we were having
weather issues and overheating.
Our engine wasn't working correctly. And it was just a lot of problems. And so I remember walking around in, I think it was Daytona or something. It was like, if we could live anywhere, where would we live? Because I think I said, if we moved to Florida, at least we could just go back and forth to the Bahamas really easily. Yeah. We wouldn't have to do the whole transit down. I was like, well, maybe we should just move to Florida so we can do that. And then it was like, well, if we're going to move to Florida, we might as well just go all the way and move to the Caribbean. And so that's comments started. Yeah. Yeah.
Snowball.
Right. Yeah, that's how we do most of our things. Right. It just snowballs.
And so then when that kind of at least temporarily fell through, we were still sort of planning to move to Puerto Rico. We just wanted to give it some time to heal and rebuild before we took Rivers there and tried to figure our whole life out. But it didn't take long after selling our house and getting into the process of moving that we just – I don't really remember exactly how we finally made that last jump. We're like, well, you know, if we just live on a boat, we can live anywhere we want. Yeah. We've had this conversation before, and we don't really remember whose thought it was at first, but it doesn't really matter because we were both like, yeah, cool. Let's go.
Yeah. 100%. Yeah.
Yeah. And well, and again, I think it's something I had wanted to do for a while, but I didn't think I could with my work. And I was at a point where I'm looking at my equipment and the requirements and learning like how to deflect sound and make a space sound good, that I realized I can do this on a boat. And boat cabins inherently sound pretty good anyway, because they're, you know, abnormally shaped. They're not a box. There's a lot of rounded surfaces, a lot of wood, a lot of cloth. And so,
yeah.
It's actually easier to make a boat cabin a good audiobook recording studio than it is a room in a house. It takes a lot less effort, honestly. So yeah. The biggest challenge is just finding quiet, because it just can't be any kind of noise in the background. And that's been the biggest challenge. You know, it means when I'm working, it means that Lauren and Rivers have to be in the front cabin and quiet or off the boat. And we have to be someplace where the ambient noise is very, very low. So that's caused the most difficulty of probably anything in this life for us, which is a very unique problem, obviously.
Yeah, I suppose it is. It's like when I have to work, you have to be so quiet.
Yeah.
No, it's really cool. So just in regarding the process of like, you did you sell your house in Charleston, then sell the smaller boat, and then buy the boat you're on now?
Yeah. But by the time we decided to sell the previous boat, we knew we were going to buy a bigger boat. So it was just, you know, one had to happen before the other. And luckily we sold that boat in a couple months. It sold pretty easily. It was a nice little boat. And then we were already in Florida, and you know, there's tons of boats there to search. We went up to North Carolina. I forget where else we went to look at boats, but wound up buying one that was 90 minutes away from us.
Nice.
Yeah.
Were you set on getting the particular model that you got, or were you like looking at a number of different models?
No. I think we knew from the outset that we wanted a very comfortable boat. Probably a production boat just because of cost and the features you could get in that package for what we had to spend. And this model wasn't even one that we were originally looking at all. We looked
Catalinas
at
Catalinas.
We looked at Catalina 460, the Beneteau 473s, which I still love those boats. Those are really cool boats.
Yeah, they sail well as well.
Yeah. And Hunter has always kind of done things a little different with their boats. A lot of design things on Hunters, especially when they came out, or we have the Traveler arch over the cockpit with the Traveler.
Yeah, it's unique.
Basically, a B&R rig with no backstay. So there's always things on Hunters that some people are leery of. And I think I was kind of the same way. But we saw a couple of these for sale, and the price was a good price point. And once we went and started looking at a couple of them, just the way they're laid out, they've got a super spacious interior.
Yeah.
And for this size of boat particularly. And so, yeah, I wasn't sure about a couple of those features, and I'm really glad we bought it, because once we got out and started sailing it, it sails great. And I really, you know, and a lot of other builders have kind of taken up some of those things. So you see more and more cruising boats with a overhead arch of some sort now. I know Beneteau took that over. I've seen some other other brands do it. The B&R rig is not a new thing, but they're using it on more boats besides just racing boats now and cats. It was kind of fun because we had to learn how to sail it a little bit, sail just a little bit differently than a traditional rig, but point's great. It's never failed us. It's extremely tough. And it's been awesome. We've really enjoyed it.
So,
it's like every other boat, constantly working on it, but.
Yeah, I mean, there's no perfect boat. And the thing, I mean, those have stood the test of time now as well. Do you know what I mean? Like, they've been making them for a long time. People have been sailing all over the place. Yeah. We don't get that many of them in Europe. And I think I've seen like 3 or 4 of them. The older ones, so like 1990s, 1980s, something like that.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, I think we've kind of had this discussion, and we've even had it in some of our videos about what it takes for a boat to be like a cruising boat and cruise worthy. And honestly, unless you're buying a brand new boat, I feel like the testing has been done for you. You know, you get a good survey, and if you have a good eye and know a little bit of what you're doing, and you go buy a boat that's 10, 15, 20 years older or even older than that, that is in good shape and it's been taken care of, it's already passed the test. You know, that boat is going to take you any place you want to go, and it's going to be able to take more than you can take. Mostly what the differences are is, you know, it's that balance between at anchor and at sail on a passage. And some people want a passage maker. They want to sail, and they want to be able to do that in comfort and feel secure and safe and have all the different, you know, good sea berths and handholds and all that. Others want to focus more on, I want to get there, and then I want to have a house, you know?
Yeah.
And so it's that balance. I don't think there's not a wrong answer, as long as you understand what you're getting. There's a lot of good boats out there.
How was it debating which boat to get? Because like usually in a relationship, one person is like very boaty, and the other one is like take it or leave it boaty. Like you guys both race, so you must have had like some conflicting opinions on something, you know, when it came to picking this boat.
No, I mean I was pretty set on the Catalina, but it just never.
The problem with those is they were never a two cabin.
Yeah, we. It was more the layout of what the boat was.
I was pretty set on that one too. Yeah. So we didn't really disagree there either.
No.
Right. This is like the perfect sailing marriage. Like now on a boat, you live in the same boats. You live on a boat, traveling on a boat.
Yeah. I'm the more OCD of the two of us, and so I go down all the wormholes, like researching boats and every little aspect of them, and then you know I rattle off paragraphs of nonsense to her, and she's like, okay, cool.
I do feel like you do all the work, and I'm just like, as long as you've got everything to back up, I'll look at all your references later. Like, that's cool.
Check out later on, is he doing it right? Yeah, he is. It's okay. Give it a tick. So how was like when it came to like the planning of moving aboard and like leaving a house, what type of things did you have to think about when it came to like having a kid and then educating a kid when you were traveling as well?
Well, he was, how old was he when we left? 3, right?
Yeah, when we just moved aboard, he had just turned 3, and he'll be 6 in 5 days. Mm-hmm. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah. So I don't know if we, he was pretty contained then, I feel like, and it's exploded now more than what it was
right,
then.
Right. And plus, we had a lot of conversations about, I don't know, the current state of the world and raising a child in it, with school shootings and bullying, both physical and online, and so much of, you know, this is not going to be news to anybody in the world, but there are so many places in America and other countries that people are kind of in their bubble and they don't see outside of it, whether they don't want to or whether they can't, is up for debate, I think, sometimes. But but we just didn't want to raise him inside some of that kind of mentality, and there was a lot of hate in the world. There still is about the time that we were thinking of taking off, and you know, there were some major political mistakes made in the United States right around that time. And we won't go farther into that, but yeah, we just kind of wanted to take him outside of that bubble and show him as much of the world as we possibly could, so that the norm for him growing up would be seeing kids of different colors that speak different languages and live completely different ways than he does, or from what he sees on TV or whatever might be the case. And, you know, learn the geography of the world instead of just, you know, your town or whatever yeah. might be the case. And as far as education goes, you know, we still have our questions about that. Lauren is homeschooling for the most part, but he's just turning 6. So we're just now kind of getting into it a little more in depth. Mm. But just being in this lifestyle, we're so present with him all yeah. the time. And, you know, we're not trying to act like we know parenting or know the right way to do anything. But, you know, when two parents are working 9-to-5 jobs, you know, your child is in the hands of somebody else for a large portion of your life and his life. And just to be able to be there when he has a random question about something and, you know, you go Google it together if you don't know it, or you, you know, tell him what you know, or, you know, we're constantly moving. So he's learning how the boat works and all the mechanical aspects of that I think help shape him. You know, we teach him reading on a constant basis. We read to him, and he's already reading books way beyond what we would expect for his age with almost no effort on our part. And I think it's just, we're always there and kind of with him and helping along these aspects of his learning.
Yeah.
And as I sit here, he's like standing on the couch, hanging from a railing, but
just about to kill himself by doing something yeah. crazy. Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you always have that, you know, you talk so proudly about your kids and then he turned around and he's just like eating his snot. And you're like, oh, that's okay. Yeah.
Yeah. He's hanging
yeah.
from one arm.
You know? Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's got a marker in the other hand.
Yeah, I'm not playing. I'm playing Bedwars. Okay. Oh, okay. That's not bad. All right. Yeah. I just think it's such a good thing to do. Like, you know, looking back on my like teenage years before I started traveling, you think you know a lot, but when you've only been in one city or, you know, a couple of cities, you know, you've just traveled around, you know, your country. I mean, like the UK is pretty like diverse anyway. Like the cities are really cosmopolitan and we've right. always had like a really open society. So we benefit from that. But gosh, I knew nothing until I started traveling the world. Like nothing, like until you've, and you know, the thing is as well, it's like until you go to some countries that where the people really don't have a lot, you can't appreciate what you have. And I think to bring a kid up in an environment where, you know, he can realize how lucky he is because he can see how the real world is, not just how America is or how London is or how Paris is or whatever. Yeah, it's massive benefit. It's a huge benefit. And, you know, you're raising your kid instead of teachers.
Right.
No discredit to teachers, but, you know,
my mom was
I would rather raise my kid than a teacher, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, you know, we're relearning as well. We're both raised that same way, you know, the standard kind of American system of how you're raised. And I had a great childhood. I'm not knocking how I was raised at all. I had a loving mother and great family and a small town upbringing and all that. But, you know, we're relearning how things can be done and relearning, you know, we're adults, so we know there's more out there, but we're still surprised by things. And that's kind of a challenge these days, I think, for people to be surprised by much of anything. It's too easy to get online and see things from a distant perspective and then think you know what that thing is all about.
Yeah, good point.
But then to actually see it or do it for yourself in person, it can be very enlightening. So yeah, we're raising him that way, but we're kind of, I think we're relearning our own way as well. And you know, I'm an old dog, so I don't know how many new tricks I've got left in me, but.
Yeah. So in the States, if you want to homeschool your kid, is that straightforward? Like you just don't send your kid to school and you just start teaching them yourself? Or is there like a system, like is it a federal system or does it depend on the state you're in? How does that work?
It's more by state.
Yeah, it depends on the state. We are technically, I believe, registered in Florida, which is a very hands-off, if you want to be hands-off, education-wise. So I haven't done anything for kindergarten, and we're looking into kind of homeschooling programs for first grade this coming up year. But I don't know. We'll see. So far, I feel like it's worked, so I'm hesitant to do anything different, but I know that he's going to outgrow me really soon.
that would be such a terrible point in your life where you start reading your kid books and he's like, yeah, I know that, Skip. And you're like, oh gosh, I didn't. Like,
yeah. He corrected me on something today. I forget what it was. Or you, or I forget. There was something kind of random. I'm like, oh wow. We're at that point now.
Yeah.
Well, that's early for that point. Like coming up to six. Yeah. It's crazy, right? Okay. Yeah. I think though as well, like when it comes to like raising kids on boats, I mean, what's it like from a social aspect? Because I've always wondered that. Because we've got like a 2.5-year-old and we're, you know, making plans and thinking about it. The only thing that we're concerned about is, I mean, we're not the most academic. I was, but not by choice, by force. My mum said to me, like, if you don't do well at school, we'll just kill you. So I was forced into studying. So yeah, I'm not that worried about that. But like when it comes to the social aspects, like do you put in a lot of effort when you get to an anchorage to like go and find other families or see if there's any kids clubs on the beach or something like that?
We're doing more and more of that.
Yeah.
Nice.
Usually it is a pretty small community of like the boat families and kids with boat kids. So usually you know somebody who at least knows somebody else and you've been in contact with, you know, your boat friend that you left in Martinique went that way and they're like, oh well, if you're going to the BVI's, look up, you know, XYZ boat, they've got kids around your age. So it is really, really small in that way.
And the more boats that we've become friends with, the more of that kind of network we get.
Right.
You know, somebody that we haven't seen for ages might message us and say, hey, some friends of ours, I think they're in the same place as you, they've got two kids. And
nice.
You know, we essentially started our real cruising in Grenada after kind of plowing through the lockdowns and all the initial COVID stuff and making our way finally to Grenada, which is just an epic family zone for cruisers. There's just kids galore, and with virtually no effort, we found ourselves in a band of about what, 5 or 6 boats that all had kids of varying ages.
Nice.
Rivers was on the lower end of the age, but he wasn't the youngest. And that's, so it can be really, really great because, like I was kind of touching on before, you know, Rivers has now had friends from multiple countries, different ages, boys and girls, and cruising kids all learn to just play with whoever's around. You know, there's not that
so selective of friends.
there's not the age boundary thing. And as those kids get older, some of the older kids we've met are just amazing kids. Yeah. And they're so good with the younger kids, and they've been that kid before. The downside is, and this is a big one, that eventually everybody splits up. And as we were all sort of moving north through the islands, especially with COVID being very much unresolved, as everybody was moving north, some people were going to hang it up for a couple years. Some people were going to continue on. Some were going to park their boat for a while and come back to it. And so all the friends we had sort of were going in different directions. And so you have to say goodbye to everybody. Sometimes in a very short span, we've made friends that we hung out with for a month, and now we're separated again. As adults, it kind of sucks. You know, we come to really, really like these people, and it's hard to have to say goodbye. But as a kid, especially a kid his age, you don't really 100% understand, well, why can't we just go where they're going, or why don't they just come where we're going? And there hasn't been any, like, major huge scenes or anything like that, but
no.
I always hate that part. I hate when we have to split ways with another boat. And then there are stretches where you find yourself without any other kid boats. And that was the situation we were in this hurricane season when we were at the west end of Puerto Rico. We spent hurricane season at Marina Pescaderia at Puerto Real. And we just kind of assumed that's a very popular marina for travelers coming down from the States through the Bahamas, Dominican Republic, and then they hop over the Mona Passage, and that's generally where they go, hang out there for a while, and then they make their passage on east. So we sort of assumed that there would be at least a few family boats there, and there was not one, not a single one. So, you know, so that was 3 months where, you know, Rivers didn't have any specific friends. There were some local kids that their parents had boats there that he'd play with once in a while. He's become very outgoing because he wants to make friends anywhere he can. So
nice.
You know, he found friends to play with, and we had a lot going on during that period. So it kept us busy. We were traveling back to the States and all that. But those stretches are, you know, we haven't done this for long, but we've already experienced a couple of those where there's just no other kids for him to play with. And we know he needs that. So
yeah,
it has caused us to be more on the lookout. And, you know, honestly, some of our best friends that we cruised with when we left Puerto Real had just crossed the Mona Passage. They had 3 kids on their boat, and they were just stopping there for a few nights. Mm-hmm. And there was a Halloween party, and we were hanging around. They were sitting at a table. I'm like, hey, those guys have kids. I'm just going to go talk to them, you know?
I think that's what I'd be like.
Yeah. We would have normally done before. I went and struck up a conversation with them, and Rivers was already playing with their kids even before that. And so we wound up cruising with them all the way to BVI. And they've since moved on to St. Martin, but we're probably going to be following them pretty soon. But yeah, it's it doesn't take too much effort, but you have to be a little proactive about it to try to find those companions so that, you know, Rivers isn't.
And there are Facebook pages and stuff that you can get connected that way too. And you can kind of find out who's there. We've not really utilized that too much just because I feel like.
But you always keep your eye on it.
I think we should get some type of burgee system set up. Do you know, like if you've got outgoing kids on the board, just put like this flag and then all the people with kids can just, that's a good idea, actually.
Well, I think that burgee is actually just the naked children running around on the deck.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. It's like the screaming and all that type of stuff.
Tend to give themselves away. Yeah. We all joke about how, you know, we're the ones screaming at our kid and our kid's on the bow yelling at people. Yeah. You know who we are.
And our friends all say the same thing. So. Yeah, good point. Yeah. So how has the journey been since you actually left Florida? Like, what type of route did you take? And then I know, like, COVID would have probably played a part in that as well. But how has the sailing been on this boat so far?
Gosh, we essentially jumped into cruising right with COVID.
Yeah.
It happened almost the exact same time.
Right. We left in November. We left Florida in November and then
2019.
So March is when everything
started to blow up.
This time, actually, because we were planning River's birthday party and then that got shut down. So we had a couple months of it, but then we had really bad wind in the Bahamas. I feel like
we had kind of a rough start, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, obviously we weren't alone in those that had to deal with the COVID issues, but that was a particularly kind of rough winter in the Bahamas. And, you know, weather front after weather front blowing through that, you know, 20, 25 knots of wind for 4 or 5 days.
Where you have to
sit in an anchorage and not be able to do a whole lot.
Right. Yeah. We learned to quarantine before it was cool.
Yeah, we were quarantining before COVID. So we kind of made our way south through the Bahamas a little faster than we intended to, because we were just trying to find, maybe if we get farther south, it'll be not so cold and not so windy and crazy. And wound up in Georgetown in the Exumas for kind of an extended stay. We had some family come visit, we had a little flotilla at that point too, of boats that we were traveling with. But then, yeah, when COVID hit the Bahamas, they got pretty hardcore in right off the bat. There was a whole lot of blame being pointed at cruisers, I don't know, we were bringing COVID to their shores or something. It's what it kind of felt like.
Like the locals weren't liking it so much, or something like that.
Local police, you weren't allowed on shore except for like an hour, and there were very specific times, and they would be pretty militant about if you were, I was walking the dog just a little bit after 6 o'clock one time and kind of had a run in with a police officer that was unpleasant. But
nobody was arrested.
No, luckily.
For walking a dog, can you imagine? I bet a few people have been arrested for walking a dog during COVID, actually. They were in Spain.
Yeah. So we were watching the weather, and it was, very first of April, and a very unusual weather system was coming through that gave us about an, an 8-day window of good sailing down to the Caribbean. So we basically sailed directly to the USVI in one, 5-day passage.
Oh, cool.
Not really knowing what we were going to get when we got here exactly. But once we did, we actually had a great stay here. And we're here for 5 months?
Yeah.
And just from what we've heard from other cruisers, this was definitely one of the better places to be. As far as the things they were imposing on people, there were a lot of things that were still open. You could still, most of the time, you could go to beaches and stuff. They weren't letting people sail around for a while, but then that kind of loosened up. Mostly our focus became, are we going to quit and bail on this? Like a lot of people were, because Grenada was not open.
Right.
And we needed to get to Grenada for hurricane season for insurance purposes and obviously safety reasons. And so it was sort of a roll of the dice to sit around and wait and see if Grenada was going to come up with a system to allow cruisers in. So we did. We sat and waited, and sure enough, they did. It was called Cross Ag or something like that. That's probably not right. But it was a system they put in place with the Cruising Association in Grenada that allowed cruisers to move into Grenada, even though their borders were closed to everybody, just for the purposes of sheltering for hurricane season.
Oh, well, that's nice that they came to that conclusion. Yeah.
And so we made it, there were some complications with that because you had to register for a specific window of time of like 3 days. And then you had to get there during those days, period, which makes passage planning a little dicey.
And you have to leave. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And we did have a false start there. We set out with a lot of time to get ourselves there in our window. And it just was a squally, nasty weather system at that point. Squall after squall, just kind of getting beat around. And we're like, man, do we want to do this for 3 days when St. Croix is 2 hours away? And so we just sort of made a right turn and went to St. Croix in the middle of another squall. And we sat there for, 2 days? Just kind of enjoyed St. Croix, rented a car, hung out. And then with 2.5 days to spare, we set out again. And then we made an incredibly fast passage. We got to Grenada from St. Croix in less than 2.5 days, virtually all under sail. And
nice.
Got there, I think, with 2 hours to spare before our window was
closed. Oh, my gosh. What would have happened if you would have missed that window? Like, you're not coming in.
You know, I think they were being pretty reasonable about it.
Okay.
At that point, I think they started to realize, oh, yeah, people do have to kind of avoid weather and make smart passages. Right. So we'd heard that some people got there even a day or two late, and it was not really a big issue. But you don't know that at the time. So our trip from Bahamas to Grenada was basically two big passages, you know, one passage to the USVI and one passage to Grenada. And so then, it was just about living in Grenada and cruising around and learning the islands down there, Carriacou and Grenada, and eventually finally getting out and doing more real cruising where we're making a lot of stops.
Yeah. And then, so what was the reason for then coming back? Because you're now back in the Virgin Islands. Did you not see enough of them when you stopped the first time around?
Well, the Virgin Islands has become our
Yeah, it feels very homey when we come back. We're like, oh yeah, we know where to anchor here. We know where to go get groceries. We know how to do all this stuff.
But, it's not a bad place to call home, is it?
Because we kind of hopped up the islands after Grenada. We went to the Grenadines and St. Vincent, but we did miss a lot kind of in the middle of most of the French islands.
A lot of places just still weren't open yet.
Yeah, St. Martin we went to St. Martin, sorry, St. Lucia.
Martinique
and Dominica and Guadeloupe. Yeah. So we got back up here. We really wanted to get to the BVIs was the big one. So we got back up here. We decided to spend hurricane season in the hurricane zone and do Puerto Rico. Just so that we could hopefully slowly make our way back down this season and actually be able to see those places and to cruise. And
our hope back then was actually what is happening is that things would start to open up and hopefully we'd be seeing the end of COVID, fingers crossed, and making cruising a little smoother.
Still got the fingers crossed on this one.
We it's just so as Americans, it's very easy to check in and out of the USVI and we can get Amazon shipments here and, you know, always need stuff for the boat and random stuff that's hard to find when you're down in the islands, especially really down in the Windward Islands.
Yeah.
So we wind up being here fixing things usually and then we take off again. So we're about to head off, probably in about 3 weeks. Probably St. Martin first, but then we're going to probably hit all the French islands. I think that's kind of the plan, Guadeloupe and Martinique, and then whatever else we can kind of squeeze in before hurricane season is upon us. And then from that point, we'll either stay. We don't know if we'll stay the whole hurricane season in Grenada or maybe just partial, and then hop on down to the ABCs in Colombia, Central America.
Nice.
Make our way up that part of the Caribbean next.
That was kind of our plan when we left, but now we're doing it.
Yeah, that's where we would be now.
Instead of the one that we'd planned.
Had we been able to see more of this side of the Caribbean in that first season, we would probably be in ABC somewhere right now, I bet. By this point. So.
Yeah, it's sometimes good to do it slow, though. I mean, you know, you've got to spend more time in nice anchorages, in a way.
Right.
Take it a bit easier.
Not really a downside to it. And we do have bigger crossings in mind in the future, Atlantic, eventually Pacific, but with rivers, and it's not so much of a, not like a safety concern or anything like that with having him along, but I think we just want him to be a little bit older, especially for the Pacific part.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even for the Atlantic, you know, I want him to experience it and remember more of it.
It's such a big accomplishment.
Yeah, yeah, it's a good thing. Really nice. Exactly.
Yeah.
Remember, yeah. And talk about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, can you imagine, like, you're 10 or 11 years old, and it's like, oh, what are your achievements? Oh, I've crossed the Atlantic at, like, 10 yeah. years old. That's incredible, actually.
Right. And that's an age where you can take a lot from it. You can retain a lot from it and remember it, and it could be a little more valuable experience than when you're, you know, 6 or 7. So we're not in a big hurry. We don't have a tight schedule for anything. And we set off with that sort of mindset. You know, we always said we wanted to stay places for several months instead of several weeks.
Yeah.
Just to sort of get a feel for the place and sort of learn how it ticked and get to know some of the locals and the local places and all that. And whether intentionally or not, we've definitely done that.
Yeah.
we've stayed some places far longer than we wanted to, but
I've got a question, right? It's a bit off topic. So there's a large difference when it comes to expenses in like the Caribbean, Bahamas, the Southern Caribbean, that type of stuff, for like groceries when you go into mm-hmm. shops to get vegetables or fast food right. or whatever. Have you figured out like which are the best islands to go to shop for certain things and then don't go to this one to shop for certain things? Because like those French islands are pricey.
What was that again?
The French islands, they're pretty pricey.
Not in our experience, but we've only been to St. Martin. Yeah.
Okay.
St. Martin is just like heaven when it comes to groceries and kind of just buying normal stuff.
Right. Like, you know, underwear and clothes. You know, after a year, you need the department store things.
Yeah.
But Puerto Rico.
And eating out. And like eating out in the French side of St. Martin was awesome. Yeah. We don't do a ton of that because it is so expensive, but gosh, when you can go get a couple croissants and a couple lattes and it costs $8 or $9
that's good
for everything. Yeah. We wound up doing that too much.
The Bahamas was definitely the most expensive that we've experienced.
Yeah.
And so then I think we went straight from the Bahamas to here and we're so like, oh, back to normal prices, but now we've been so many other places that this feels expensive.
Yeah.
But Puerto Rico was
Puerto Rico is basically like shopping in the U.S.
It's got the big stores and Walmarts and things. And then St. Martin was, you can get wine for basically nothing.
French wine. Yeah. French wine for $2.
French wine.
Everything
else. Yeah.
You know, and then you've got a lot of conversion EC, so it's hard for me to...
Sometimes it is hard to think back, okay, how did Grenada and SVG compare? Because you're doing everything in EC instead of dollars. And, you know, we was what, about 5-2 or something like that? So it's kind of hard sometimes to do that comparison in your head. And we're not the type to sit and make a spreadsheet of like how much our cabbage cost or anything like that.
Yeah. So.
But Grenada was, I don't remember Grenada being particularly expensive to buy food. There just wasn't as much of a selection. A lot of the stuff that you get used to using, you just kind of have to work around it or come up with a different, you know, and we learned really quick not to buy, name brands. A lot of the US brands that we got used to, you buy whatever's local, and especially down in Grenada, they ship in a lot of stuff from New Zealand and UK. Mm-hmm. And so we just kind of learned to try new stuff from new products and new manufacturers, and it was fine. You know, we've never been ones that like we have to have our Oreos or anything like that. So we're pretty lucky that we don't have any big hangups when it comes to type of things that we eat or use. So.
Yeah, it's quite strange in the Caribbean, because it's like, if you are, you know, like if you live in, I mean, the state, I'd imagine the States is pretty similar to like the European Union in a way, from like a customs mm-hmm. and trade perspective, because it's like,
right.
yeah, federal government, EU, kind of similar-ish. I don't know. I hope I don't offend anyone by saying that. I probably could be completely wrong.
Yeah.
But yeah, you've got like countries that are like the same size as American states in a way, and they all work together. So yeah, it's kind of similar. But like in Spain, you get a lot of stuff from like Italy and France and Germany because they're really close. Whereas Caribbean, because they are like relying on the trading histories of their like colonial countries in a way, like France, UK, America, right. like Puerto Rico and stuff. Like the ones, the British ones are crazy. Like, I'm like, why don't these guys just buy beans from Mexico? Like, why do they buy beans from like England? You know?
Right.
Or like the French. So it's like New Zealand's like, obviously that's Commonwealth. So the trade, they're bringing in stuff from New Zealand. I'm like, well, you got Colombia there. Yeah, it's really strange.
Yeah, I don't understand that either. And it's also, I'm sure it's a lot of politics and how it works, but with St. Martin, you know, they were doing exactly what you say. They were bringing everything from France.
Yeah, it's nuts.
Don't know. I think Martinique works the same way, but it was cheap. The prices there were no worse than they would be if you were to buy the stuff in France, from what I understand.
I don't know.
Well, just talking to locals and people that know more than we do. So I don't know if it's something about how that commerce is regulated, but it just seems like France does a very good job of taking care of their trade with their Caribbean countries, at least just that little bit that we've seen. Because it really was not expensive at all compared to, you know, most things we've seen.
And
the selection of stuff was just unbelievable, you know, in the groceries. Dutch side too, but we didn't spend as much time on the Dutch side.
I think France has probably got the largest presence in the Caribbean out of any of the European countries.
It's got to be between them and the Netherlands, right?
Probably.
Yeah,
because I know the UK is, I mean, Grenada, Virgin Islands. I don't know that much about the history of the Caribbean, to be Grenada honest. It's quite tarred, so I don't pay that much attention to it. It's not the greatest history when it comes to Britain.
UK's got BVI and Antigua.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
That's their associations. Grenada is their own thing now.
Right.
SVG, I don't think they have an association particularly. But then the ABCs, that's, you know.
The Dutch, right?
Dutch.
Netherlands, yeah.
Barbados, they just went independent like a few weeks ago, actually.
Who did?
Barbados, because that was.
Really?
Yeah, they did like a festival for it, and like our. Prince Charles went over there, and then like they had Rihanna on stage as well, which is quite cool. She's like, you know, the Queen of Barbados or something. It's very famous.
Right.
Yeah. So that's cool. So how, just with regards to like the work and earning money and stuff, like you've been able to set up your little studio on the boat, which has worked really well. Like Lauren, how's that worked for you since you started cruising and living on the boat?
Yeah, I mean, I get the table, and I get the V berth, and we've just got like a desk and a laptop that I move back and forth depending on where I need to be. I don't really have a specific.
Right. The nice thing about YouTube is you can do it any little corner that you need to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and she's still practicing your haircutting skills now and then. There's a lot of cruisers that need haircuts.
Yeah, but there is. Yeah.
I'll get my scissors out. So.
At what point did it become, so obviously like the YouTube stuff, you did it for personal reasons. It's something you wanted to do. At what point did it become like a path in which you can like, you know, make a bit of money from it, or it can contribute towards, you know, the monthly budget, something like that?
I think the first, when we first got a glimpse that it could go that way was really when we were gearing up to buy this boat, because we started off with a series about all the different boats we looked at and weighing them against each other and the criteria that we were using just personally to buy a boat and all that. And those videos, comparably to what we had done, did very, very well. And there was definitely just a lot of interest there. And so I think when those did well, I think that made us kind of perk up and say, oh, yeah, this, we could maybe make, you know, we're not naive about YouTube and social media. There's an awful lot of lightning in a bottle that happens to, you know, make some channels successful while others aren't. And there's only so much banging your head against the wall you can do trying to manipulate all the different things that you think might work in your favor. But I think at that point we decided to kind of take it a little more seriously in like how we structure our videos and trying to tell more of a story. And, you know, we've since even done some courses to try to learn, you know, what kind of titles and thumbnails and things like that to use. That, again, I can't honestly say how successful those things are individually, but as a whole, we've been able to put more into it and get more out of it.
Just the thought of it.
Yeah.
We had to think about it now.
Just think about it. Instead of just like putting together whatever footage came next and just kind of saying, hey, here's a video. You know, we started putting a lot more thought into it, and it still wasn't a, you know, not that it's blown up yet. We're still one of the smaller channels, but, you know, in the last year or so, we've definitely seen a lot of growth, and it feels like it has followed our efforts to try to tell a story and try to be much more deliberate about what we're trying to say and you know, what the, not the lesson, but the story is in each video. So that's what we just kind of continue to do and see what
happens. Definitely more marathon than a sprint.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have to remind ourselves a lot. Yeah. But
yeah, it's it. I just think it's such an unnatural thing to go about your daily life and then be like, oh, would other people want to see me doing this? You know, and then I take a time out to like get a camera or something. Like, it'd probably take some getting used to, I'd imagine. Well,
that is something I think that we've figured out for sure, is that it's not really about the destination or specifically what sites you're looking at. You know, it's not National Geographic. I don't think that's what most people are watching these videos for. They want to connect to the people in the videos and, you know, how we interact with each other and our day-to-day life. And so it could be something. We've had videos where we didn't really go anywhere or do anything particularly interesting. But there was a lot of lifestyle in the videos and they did really well. And, you know, going to, we went to Annapolis this year and took part in the YouTube booth for the first time. Well, I guess it was kind of the first time for the actual booth this year. And so we got to sit with other YouTube channels and, like, you know, meet fans and answer questions and all that. And I think that was kind of telling too, because when you talk to people, it's really just more about the fact that we're out here living this life, and they just want you to be real and go about your life and kind of let them in on it, so to speak. It's not about the most beautiful shots or the most epic locations. It's really, I think it's that personal connection that people are more interested in that we try to present.
Yeah. No, I think it's good. I mean, it's like reality TV that's actually real, because reality TV isn't real. It's the most fakest thing in the world. So yeah, it's like the real version of it in a way, which is, which keeps it pretty interesting. So what's the plan for the rest of the year then? You're going to be slowly heading down south.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, we're, like I said, we're like 3 weeks probably. We got, family coming in Sunday, right?
Yeah.
And then after they've taken off, we're going to head to St. Martin probably first, just because it's next up. It's the easiest place to get to from here.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And we like it. But yeah, I think Guadeloupe, I don't think we'll go back to Antigua probably, just because we have too many places we want to see.
Right. No, we haven't been. But
yeah.
Yeah. And then ABCs, and we're hoping to Colombia, mm-hmm. Panama.
Right.
Nicaragua, I think, was on the. But we'll see.
Yeah, she's looking at the map.
I know, yeah. We've got to.
You know, I should do that. I talk to people about countries all the time. Then I'm all like, never remember. That's actually a good idea.
We found a cool, like, sort of old school looking Caribbean map and mounted it on Foam Core, and then we just put a pin every place that we've been.
Yeah.
It's really helped Rivers too. He knows where we are.
He's got great Caribbean geography. Yeah. But he thinks like the United States is in Ohio.
Yeah, we talk about like Washington DC. He's like, that's in Ohio, right? It's like,
that's fine.
Yeah, so your United States geography is probably slightly better than our son's, but he's really good at the Caribbean part.
Yeah. That's good. Cool. Well, listen, thanks very much for taking the time to like tell us your story and like a bit more how you manage your lifestyle. It's really interesting. And thank you for making all those videos. They're really entertaining. It's great watching you as a family.
Thanks so much, man. We appreciate doing these kind of things and are flattered to be invited. So yeah. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, cool. Very welcome.